Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to Space Junk. My name is Annie Hanma, and today's podcast is all about our place in space. I'm currently in Melbourne. On Wednesday evening, I'll be moderating a panel discussion with Alice Gorman, aka Dr. Space Junk, Donna Lawler, Kerry Doherty, Gabrielle Harris, and Keridwen Dovey. The event is a public forum on the moon, put on by the Moon Village Association and the Office of Other Spaces. If you're in Melbourne and you're interested in attending, you can head to www.mvapublicforum.com. In anticipation of the event, and to provide a bit of a taster, I caught up with Kerry Doherty, a brilliant space historian who will be on Wednesday's panel, to reflect on Australia's history with the Apollo program and how we see our place in the universe.
Hello, my name's Kerry Doherty. I work with the Australian Space Agency, but I'm also a space historian and have been for many years. I used to work with the Powerhouse Museum, where I was the curator of space technology. And in fact, I was with the Powerhouse for just over 30 years.
And Kerry, you were responsible for making that fantastic space exhibition at the Powerhouse, is that right? And securing some of the big exhibits.
Yes. Yeah, the space exhibition, or both versions of the space exhibition at the Powerhouse, were my babies, you might say. And when we were developing the Powerhouse, so this is in the 80s, and I was asked to take on developing the space exhibition, one of the things I really wanted to do at that time was to, because this was still the Cold War, was to show that there were many nations involved in space, and it wasn't just NASA and the United States, as wonderful as their accomplishments are, but to show that the Soviet Union had a space program, China had a space program, Europe had a space program, and even Australia was doing things and had been doing things in space. So I was really looking very broadly at material that I could bring in for the exhibition. And for people who've seen the exhibition, you'll know it's in a very large cathedral-like space, the old boiler hall. So we also wanted some large objects which would fill that, make use of that space. And in fact, part of the way we worked it when the Soviet Union particularly came to the party and offered us a number of replicas of different space probes and spacecraft, and we actually hung them from the ceiling, from the roof, so that you had the idea of spacecraft in orbit. And then the great height in the building actually gave us that opportunity.
How did you go about securing these artifacts from the Soviet Union at the time? That must have been quite complicated.
It was a lengthy process of loan negotiation. Probably the hardest part was actually finding the right people to talk to. Once we found the correct people that we needed to be talking with, it was a lot more straightforward, but there was still a great deal of negotiation, which involved a lot of diplomatic diplomatic involvement of the Foreign Affairs Department and so forth, and the embassies, well, the Soviet embassy here.
I bet.
Yeah, so it took several years. I mean, I started working on the exhibition in 84, and we opened the exhibition in the October of 88. So it was essentially a four-year program to develop it.
Mm. Those who have visited or remember the exhibition will know that there was also a real focus on Australia and our place within space and our history with space. And Kerry is also the author of a book, Australia in Space, which is an excellent read if anyone is interested. But Kerry, I was hoping you could do for us a sort of back of the envelope, very quick rundown on Australia's history with space, and in particular, focusing on Australia's history with the moon.
asking for a back of the envelope description of Australia's space activities in like 5 minutes is almost impossible. I managed to do it in 12 once, but
well, we'll see how we go.
let's actually focus on the relationship of Australia with the moon program, because in fact, ours was a very significant role. Many people, of course, will have seen the movie The Dish, so that, you know, they know, even though that movie is not exactly factually accurate, they know that Australia was involved with bringing the television from the moon to the world. But we actually had a broader association, which goes back to the beginnings of the space age. Because when the United States was planning to launch their first satellite as part of the International Geophysical Year, so this is the period of 1957-58, having a satellite in orbit is not much good if you don't know where it is and you can't get data from it. And so what they had to develop along with the satellite was a global network of tracking stations that could track the satellite in orbit and receive data from it. And for a number of geographical and political reasons, Australia was very well placed to be the site of, there were two different tracking networks that were developed. One was a radio network called Minitrack, and the other was an optical network using a very advanced telescopic camera, which is referred to as a Baker Nun. And Australia happened to be very well placed for both of these systems to be stationed here. And they were both set up initially at Woomera as part of the tracking of this first satellite. In fact, Australia was the only place where the two types of systems could both be located in the same place, because Woomera just happened to have ideal environmental conditions both for the radio tracking and the optical tracking. And that began Australia's association with the United States in space tracking. Now, NASA didn't even exist at this point. NASA didn't come into existence until 58. And when it did, it took over this tracking network that had been developed for the Vanguard satellite for the IGY. And that then began Australia's association with NASA, which expanded fairly rapidly as NASA's own programs expanded. So in 1960, we had the first deep space tracking station established at Island Lagoon, which was just outside Woomera. And this was for deep space probes. Now, essentially, that initially meant the probes to the moon. So some of the very earliest spacecraft that were sent out away from the Earth were trying to get to the moon, essentially for the precursors of the Apollo program, to find out exactly what the moon, what the surface of the moon was like before we sent astronauts there. Because there were several theories about the surface of the moon that suggested that, in fact, it might be a dangerous place to try and land astronauts. There was one school of thought that the moon might be covered with dust, layers of dust that were so deep that literally if the lunar module landed on it, it would sink down into the dust and disappear. You know, and that could be a bit embarrassing.
Right.
And there was actually another school of thought that thought that perhaps oxygen chemically trapped in the lunar dust might somehow combust as a result of the pressure of the lunar module or an astronaut's footstep, you know, stepping on it. Yeah, that could be a bit embarrassing if Neil Armstrong had stepped out onto the lunar surface and disappeared in a sheet of flame. So, you know, they really needed to know what the surface of the moon was actually like. And there were two three space programs, Ranger, Lunar Orbiter, and Surveyor. And they were sort of sequentially exploring the surface of the moon. So the Ranger probes were designed to crash into the moon and just make sure the surface was hard, you know, that there wasn't this dust that you'd sink into. The Lunar Orbiters are exactly what their name said. They went around the moon, took very detailed photographic mapping of the moon to look at the best landing sites for Apollo. And then the Surveyors actually landed on the lunar surface to actually make sure that a spacecraft could softly touch down, that an astronaut could step out. And they had these great scoops on board that would, you know, you could watch the images of it picking up or taking scoops out of the lunar soil to test its mechanical properties, things like that. And so all of these missions Australia played a part in through Island Lagoon, and then in the mid-60s, the Tidbinbilla tracking station, which was established near Canberra, which of course still exists today as the Canberra Deep Space Communications Centre. So they were both involved in that tracking. And at the same time as the human spaceflight program got underway, so you had the Mercury program, which was the single astronaut spacecraft, then Gemini, which was the two-person spacecraft, where they were actually testing out techniques that they would need for the Apollo mission, so rendezvous in space, space walking, living in space for a period of up to 2 weeks. So for those, they also needed special type of tracking and communication station. And one of these was established at, well, in fact, for the Mercury program, there was one established at Mooshay in Western Australia and another one at Red Lake, which was also near Woomera. And then for the Gemini program, they closed Mooshay, but they opened another station at Carnarvon in Western Australia. So that these were all enabling NASA to keep in touch with the astronauts as they were circling the Earth, you know, to ensure, obviously, not just that they could get data from the astronauts, but to ensure astronaut safety. And in fact, the Mercury station at Mooshay in Western Australia was the only command station outside the United States. So it was almost exactly halfway around the world from Cape Canaveral. So if an astronaut got into trouble and was perhaps incapacitated in orbit, the station at Mooshay could send a signal to fire the retros and bring the astronaut back to Earth, which meant that you could do that at Canaveral, or you could do it at Mooshay, so the astronaut was essentially only about 45 minutes from being able to re-enter and get down to help if he needed medical help. So, you know, it was all part of the process of astronaut safety as well. And then with the Apollo program itself, because Apollo was going to be going to the moon, they needed additional stations that could specifically receive the signals from lunar distance. And they established three of these around the world, and they paired them with the Deep Space Network stations so that when you had the the command module and the lunar module operating independently around the moon, because the lunar module would be on the surface, the command module would still be in orbit with another astronaut in it. So you needed to be in communication and receiving data from both. And in this way, one of the manned spaceflight network stations could be concentrating on one spacecraft, and the Deep Space Network station nearby, which was like its twin, could concentrate on the other spacecraft. And that, again, was ensuring, you know, additional communications and backup for the whole program. So, you know, as with Apollo, you had the manned spacecraft station, and that's what the network was called, the manned spacecraft network. That was at Honeysuckle Creek, which is not far from Tidbinbilla. So they were the twins in Australia. But the Carnarvon station also assisted with Apollo because it could track the launch of the spacecraft, make sure that Apollo was in orbit. They always did a checkout in orbit before they left for the moon. And Carnarvon actually gave that sort of go, no-go for whether, you know, whether they were in the right position to head out towards the moon. So so the two, you know, so these Australian stations were all working together to ensure, you know, the safety of and communications during the Apollo program. Mm. The everybody, of course, has seen the film The Dish. And if you haven't, shame on you. Go and see it.
It's a great film.
It's a great film. Get the DVD. You will love it. But The Dish is only a movie. We love it. It's a great little film. It's based on the true story of what happened. Mm. But its focus is particularly on the Parkes Radio Telescope. But there are actually two stations that were involved in receiving the television from the moon. And it's an interesting thing that NASA wasn't even going to have television from the moon until very late, and I mean very late, in the planning of the Apollo program. It wasn't finalised until I think it was the February of 69 that they would actually do it. So, you know, it was
cutting it close there.
It was cutting it. I mean, people were planning for it, but an actual decision from the NASA higher-ups that that they would actually do this wasn't made until the February. So a lot of people thought that it might be distracting to the astronauts to have television, apart from the fact that actually making a television camera small enough, you know, there were some people who weren't sure that that could be done or done in time. And there was an absolute genius at Westinghouse, a guy by the name of Stan Lebar, who was able to develop cameras small enough to carry, television cameras small enough to carry in the command module and then out onto the lunar surface. And he started with the black and white camera that we saw in for the Apollo 11.
Yeah.
And then he was able to develop a colour camera that they first carried on Apollo 12.
Very clever.
Very clever. But, of course, it's a very low-power signal that we're talking about being sent back from the moon. So NASA actually, I'll take a step back for a second. I've already mentioned Honeysuckle Creek. So Honeysuckle Creek was essentially going to be the prime communications station for the Apollo mission to the, you know, for Apollo 11, well, in fact, for all the Apollo missions, when the moon was in view of Australia. For Apollo 11, say Honeysuckle was going to be the prime station. There were many changes in the actual timeline of the moonwalk, and at different times it looked like Australia would be the prime station, like that the moonwalk would happen while the moon was high over Australia, and at other times it looked like it might occur while it was over the United States. So there was a bit of chopping and changing. But NASA realised that, in fact, if it was going to occur in Australia's view, that it would be a good idea to have the Parkes Radio Telescope available as an additional receiving dish for the lunar television, because it's a much bigger antenna, so it's going to be able to do much better in receiving this very weak signal. And Parkes and NASA had actually worked together previously on receiving some signals from some of the deep space probes, particularly the Mariner 4, the first spacecraft to successfully get to Mars. So you had Honeysuckle and Parkes that were both on standby, essentially, for the lunar television. So when Apollo 11 finally landed on the moon, the way the timeline worked out, the Armstrong was stepping onto the lunar surface a little before the moon was high enough in Parkes for them to receive a signal. So, in fact, the first part of the broadcast from the moon actually came through Honeysuckle Creek. And those moments when Armstrong climbs out of the lunar module, climbs down the ladder and steps onto the lunar surface, that actually comes from Honeysuckle Creek. And it was shortly after that that the moon became high enough that Parkes could get the you know, a superior quality of signal because of the bigger dish. And so at that point, NASA switched over to taking the signal from Parkes, and the television from Parkes was used for the rest of the broadcast. And of course, what was happening was the signals were coming down from the moon. They were relayed then from Honeysuckle and Parkes to Sydney, to the OTC, which was, it's now part of Telstra, but it used to be a separate agency that handled all Australia's international telecommunications.
Mm.
So it came down to Sydney. OTC decided which signal was better. They sent that signal to a satellite uplinking station at Moree, because the tracking stations didn't have the capability to uplink to the satellites in Earth orbit. So that sent it up to a satellite in Earth orbit, which sent it over to the United States. And then NASA decided, comparing with the signals that they were actually still getting from their Goldstone station, which one they would use. And in fact, the Goldstone signal wasn't that good. And so they went firstly with Honeysuckle and then with the Parkes signal, and then broadcast it out to the world. So that was, you know, how Australia played that very critical role in Apollo 11. Of course, we were involved in all the Apollo missions, and also played a very significant role in Apollo 13. In fact, we're just coming up on the 50th anniversary of that in April as well. And for those who don't remember it, go and see the Tom Hanks movie, just remembering that it is just a movie, but it's another good film, and it hits all the main, you know, all the main points of the mission. But yeah, Australia was, in fact, again, it happened to be Honeysuckle Creek that was in contact with Apollo 13 just at the time that the accident occurred. So the initial communications during the first stages of the emergency actually came through Honeysuckle Creek. And as it happened, it was also the last station, I think, to be in contact as they were coming back into Earth orbit. So that, you know, again, there were the quite critical roles during some very critical phases of the Apollo 13 mission. So, as I say, we played a role in all the Apollo missions. So, you know, that's how Australia had a very important role in Apollo.
Kerry, when we were talking about the moon and the view that we have of the moon, told me about an experience in the early 1990s with an essay competition that was run for primary school students, asking them what they thought we might do with asteroids or something of that nature. And I've asked Kerry to tell the story because there are some really interesting perspectives. So, Kerry, to you.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting thing. This was a period when the Australian government was actually promoting the development of Australian space industry, and we were looking at that time as a possible Australian involvement with future activities. And the Institution of Engineers decided to run this competition for primary school students to, you know, get them interested in space. And essentially the topic, I can't remember the exact topic, but it was along the lines of, you know, how might Australia use the asteroids? And the responses that came back, and there were several hundred, I can't remember the exact number now, but came back from all around Australia. And what was particularly interesting was that a number of the kids had, and these were from different schools scattered around the country, had all suggested that we could use the asteroids as a penal colony. And I just thought this was quite fascinating. What was it? And I really, you know, we just don't exactly know why it was that so many students from different schools, if it had all been from one school, you could say that perhaps the teacher had said something that had, you know, planted that idea in their heads, but that it came from, you know, a number of different schools. And it was just interesting that this was the thing that somehow sparked the imagination of these kids, that the asteroids could become a space jail.
Right. But we were saying earlier over lunch that this is a motif that returns in science fiction.
A lot of early science fiction used this idea of using the moon or Mars or the asteroids as a space jail or a penal colony, you know, a place to dump undesirables, you know, a bit like Australia was back in 1788.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking maybe that's why these kids had been studying Australian history and
that's
front of mind.
One of the things we sort of speculated on, that perhaps they'd, you know, done a little bit of in social studies, as it was in those days in primary school, about you know, the Botany Bay colony and the origins of Australia. And maybe that was the thing that gave them the idea. But we just don't know. But it was fascinating that so many, you know, it was a noticeable proportion of the respondents who'd come up with this idea of a penal colony on the asteroids.
Thank you so much for making time to speak with me, Kerry. It's been wonderful, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with you again on Wednesday at the Moon Village Association event in Melbourne.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that, and I hope people listening who are in Melbourne or able to get there might come along to join us and join the conversation. But thank you for having me.
No worries. And if you'd like to hear more about the history of space and the history of Australia's role in space, you can go and check out Kerry Doherty's book, Australia in Space, a really excellent resource. And you can also find Kerry's work on Star Wars, I believe.
Yeah, my secret identity is as a Star Wars reference book writer.
Yeah.
So I've co-authored three Star Wars reference books that have come out in a couple of editions, and a Doctor Who one too.
To, I must say, critical acclaim. So if you're interested in Star Wars or the history of space in Australia, Google Kerry Doherty and check out her books. They're really worth a read.
Thank you.
My discussion with Kerry got me thinking. I was fascinated with the idea that these Australian primary school children in 1990 seemed to think of space as a sort of dumping ground for undesirables and convicts, or perhaps from another perspective, as a place where individuals could escape from authoritarian regimes and form new societies on asteroids. Do today's children still think this way? I took advantage of a free day in Melbourne to visit a local Melbourne school and find out. My discussion with these kids is available in part two of this podcast, which is available now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.